Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell and welcome to the program. A human rights lawyer in Fiji says a year after a Lakota businessman, Ranel Singh, was attacked allegedly by police, no progress has been made in getting justice. The businessman says he was beaten up and left dead in Sinkato in November 2015 after reporting a plot he undercovered to overthrow the government. He was attacked again 2 months later in his home. His lawyer, Amend Rajendra Singh, told Sally Round the attacks are among several cases which prove state-sponsored torture is still going on in Fiji.
Till to date, there has been no breakthrough in either of the attacks on Rajneel. The first attack was very brutal. He was tortured by members of the security forces, picked up outside Bar police station, taken in a police vehicle into the interior of Vitilevu, very brutally tortured, and then taken and left for dead in Sinatoka. And the second attack, which took place in his own home on Tuesday 30th August 2016, was an attempted murder whereby the persons who attacked him had put a plastic bag around his head and fastened it with industrial tape, and also had tied up his hands and legs and left him to suffocate and die, literally. But all we get from the police is that investigations are continuing. Rajneel has no confidence in the investigation. I have no confidence in the investigation. It lacks transparency, there is no accountability, also it lacks independence. We maintain that there is a cover-up within the police force. The first incident was very simple. Four members of the police force had taken him from outside a police station, and yet the police are not able to identify these four persons. If you look at all the instances of torture in the last couple of years, That is the norm. That's how police are able to tone down the public outcry and emotions, and all they will say is that investigations are continuing. After the police took his statement, nothing else has happened. Perhaps the police may still be continuing with the investigations, but what has happened with the investigations from November last year? And in fact, the police do not even have the courtesy to update Reginald and his family about what goes on.
Have they done any further scene examinations, come to the house to take any fingerprints, that sort of thing?
Nothing. And we must remember that the second attack, police had not even come to the scene of crime for almost 48 hours.
We heard from the Prime Minister last week at a workshop on implementing the UN Convention Against Torture. He admitted there were isolated acts of torture, and efforts were being made to overcome these within the disciplined forces. Do you have a reaction to that?
Now, this is a huge breakthrough. There has been complete denial of torture taking place in Fiji. The Prime Minister saying that the incidents of torture in Fiji are isolated, it's completely wrong. The torture which takes place in Fiji is state-sponsored torture.
How do you know that?
It's simple. If you look back just recently in 2013 when a torture video had been leaked, and in that military and police personnel were torturing at least three escaped prisoners, we would all recall that Bainimarama went out of his way and said publicly that I stand by my men. He also maintained that this is the treatment that will be dished out to criminals.
But perhaps things have changed since then. I mean, we've seen people brought to trial. For instance, the case of Vilikesi Soko.
I'll give you a better example. In 2011, the Prime Minister directly ordered the torture of trade unionist Felix Anthony. Again, despite the complaints to police, no one has been apprehended, no one has been questioned, no one has been charged, and no one has been brought before the courts of law. And we have even identified the persons in Felix Anthony's statement. All the names of the persons are there. 5 years later, investigations are still continuing.
Staying on police brutality in Fiji, a Fijian man was picked up by police in Sava last week. He says he was beaten unconscious during his night in custody. The man, Ricardo Fisher, told Sally Rand he's filed a complaint to the police over the incident, which happened after he and a friend were picked up late Monday night after a scuffle with another group of people in the capital.
They took me back to the police station and pulled me out of the truck and beat me. In the car park of the police station. I got arrested for drunken disorderly. So they pulled me out, and a friend of mine saw me getting beaten in the car park by the police, and he tried to jump on top of me to try and stop them from beating me, so they proceeded to beat him. Then they pulled him off of me and dragged me to the police cells, beat me in front of the police cells, and then dragged me into the police cells, and then more of them came. And then I dropped to the ground as they were beating me in the cell, and I remember covering my face because they were punching my face, and then the rest of them were stomping on my body. And when I woke up, I couldn't move. So I was laying on the ground of the police cell all morning, and then they came, gave me some food. I told them I couldn't move, and I couldn't even reach for the food. So they just said, just get the food. And then then lunchtime, I laid there on the floor all morning till lunchtime. They came, bought food at lunchtime, and they said, "What, you don't want to eat?" I told them I can't move. And they just kicked the food into the cell and left me there for another hour or two. And then finally they came in to find out what was wrong with me because I was crying in pain. They finally came and carried me. They had to carry me onto the back of a police truck and then take me to the hospital from there.
You were quite heavily intoxicated, were you?
Yeah, the night, on Monday night, yes.
But you do clearly remember what happened?
I clearly remember.
So you weren't that intoxicated that you were completely blind drunk?
No, I wasn't.
So then you were in hospital for a couple of days, is that right?
Yes, till Thursday. They said I had broken ribs on both sides. I thought it was my spine because I had a lot of trouble moving. They did x-ray and scan, CT scan on my spine, and they said that there's no fractures on my spinal cord. So that was the thing that I was mostly worried about. So it was broken ribs and just bruising all along my back and my chest area.
And you were under police guard while you were at hospital?
Yes, that's right. As soon as I was discharged from the hospital, police took me back to the station and charged me for drunken disorderly and misconduct at the police station and resist arrest. So they just charged me and then they released me on bail to my parents. As soon as I was released, I lodged a complaint with the police station, telling them that I was beaten. And they just put the complaint down in their book and also lodged a complaint that I also had like $150 missing from my wallet when I received my property back. I just would like people brought to justice. I mean, because this thing seems to keep happening to everybody. People are dying, you know, and they just get away with whatever they do.
Indonesia has urged Australia to rebook Pacific Island states who raise issues related to West Papua in the global foray. Its defense minister says it asked Australia to pass on a message to Solomon Islands and other Pacific states that they should not invite West Papua to join the Melanesian Spearhead Group. They were warned not to interfere in Indonesia's domestic affairs. A fellow researcher at the Australian National University State Society and Governments in Melanesia program, Dr. Stuart Firth, told Johnny Blaze Jakarta has misinterpreted Australia's relationship with Pacific countries.
These are sovereign states. And in particular, in the case of Solomon Islands, the Solomon Islands has a right to do that as a sovereign country. And Australia's not in a very good position to tell them differently. In fact, the one thing that Pacific Island countries really value is their sovereignty. So it's not as if Australia can just tell them what to do.
In the Defence Minister's statements to Indonesian media about passing this message on, he has mentioned that Australia, basically, he mentioned Ramsey. He mentioned that Australia has a big aid package in Solomon Islands, suggesting that could be used as leverage. This is also a bit unusual.
I think so. And in fact, as we all know, the Ramsey has run down a lot. I mean, it's really almost come to an end, except for the police partnership. And that will finish in the middle of next year. Of course, there's continued to be big bilateral aid with New Zealand as well. But that doesn't mean you can then determine a country's foreign policy. There might be some, you know, whisperings behind the scenes and so on. But of course, in the end, it's going to be determined by the national interests of these countries. And In the case of Papua New Guinea, of course, O'Neill sometimes comes out with statements which seem to favour a better deal for the West Papuans. But, of course, in the end, there's no way in which Papua New Guinea can ever really take anything other than a pro-Indonesian position because, they, you know, here they are, 8 million people, you know, with a border of a country of nearly 260 million. Indonesia is a giant compared with PNG, and therefore PNG has to take into account what Jakarta thinks. It's just a question of ordinary, you know, border diplomacy.
We've seen Sogavare really step into the fold as MSG chair, but he's done a number of other things, like he's got this quasi-government NGO coalition up and running, which is where a lot of the action is taking place as well. He must be the key figure in some ways.
I think that's true, but of course you've got to then ask what these memberships and things amount to. It's very hard to see what Indonesia's associate membership actually is. We know what an observer membership is, and that's what the United Liberation Movement for West Papua has. It has an observer membership of the Melanesian Spearhead Group. What's worrying the Indonesians is the way in which this whole question of membership of the MSG has assumed a kind of symbolic political value to West Papuan independence activists. And earlier this year, we saw major demonstrations in a number of towns in West Papua, which people were arrested and so on, because they were demonstrating in favour of West Papuan membership of the MSG. So whether that actually amounts to much or not is less important than its symbolic significance.
The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization says the full extent of a crisis of non-communicable diseases in the region is yet to be fully acknowledged. Tim Martin from the FAO Fiji office says over the past decades, many people have shifted from traditional nutrient-rich diets to cheaper foods, high in sugars, salt, and fat, an unintended consequence of trade liberalization. He says this has led to the generation of Pacific Islanders having some of the highest rates of preventable diseases in the world. Dr. Martin told Jamie Tahanaha the health campaigns have raised awareness, but they do little when families can barely afford a healthier alternative, which will be the focus of a major conference this week.
Yeah, I think it's an unprecedented level of crisis in the world. You know, 7 of the 10 most obese nations are in the Pacific Islands. And as healthcare costs as a percentage of GDP is rising faster than the rate of GDP itself. So the capacity to cover the costs of healthcare is only getting worse. And at the same time, the morbidity, the early death and capacity to earn income for one's family and for the nation is also declining. So on every level, it's an unprecedented crisis. And as I said, you know, we haven't quite acknowledged that it's only just coming into sort of political consciousness.
And this isn't so much obesity and overeating, it is a big factor, but a lot of the problem is malnourishment, anemia and such, isn't it? What you call hidden hunger. What is that?
Well, we see, you know, transition of diets in the Pacific over the course of a generation towards different sorts of staple foods. So taro or kumula being substituted out and white bread or white rice coming in. And they lack the vitamin A and they lack the iron that used to be part of the traditional diet. And so as a result, you see these high rates of anemia, which, you know, causes a range of health problems. So we have made great inroads in tackling hunger itself in the Pacific. But that's only a small part of the story. What we're seeing is a shift in the sort of calorie base or the dietary base away from diets which include the essential micronutrients and, of course, diets which have a lot of salt and a lot of fat and sugar in them. So we may have achieved some gains on hunger, but it's the hidden hunger and the obesity associated with the new diet which is causing a range of healthcare costs, which is then flowing into all those other personal and national costs that we're facing in the Pacific.
And this is a direct result of policies over the past decades.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a noble policy to say, let's make food cheaper. Let's help poor households have access to cheaper food. And effectively, we've achieved that through trade liberalisation. But perhaps an unintended consequence of that process has been to incentivise consumers, incentivise households to shift towards cheaper foods at the expense of traditional foods. And as a result of that incentivisation, people have changed their diets. Local foods, there's been less investment in improving productivity there. So they've become relatively more expensive, and so consumers face a pretty easy choice buy a calorie in white bread, much cheaper than to buy a calorie in, say, kumla, sweet potato, but then you miss the micronutrients which comes with that sweet potato.
Yeah, and that creates a whole new problem in itself, doesn't it? Because people are buying the cheaper, albeit less healthy food, but if you're putting out a campaign saying buy healthy food, but it's, you know, taking half your income, people aren't exactly likely to do that, are they?
That's right, and that's what we think. It hasn't quite been acknowledged. There's an assumption that people's food choices are a personal choice, a personal preference, but price has a large influence over preferences. You may prefer to buy a Mercedes, but you can only afford a Toyota, so you're going to go out and buy what you can afford. And so households have the diet they can afford to eat, and we can educate, and we can inform, but unless we back that up with improved access to an affordable diet, particularly for the at-risk groups, then we're not going to see real dietary change. And so that's why we're having this conference next week, to bring sort of the scale of attention to this problem and the range of actors required to develop the solutions that Pacific Islands need, and indeed all small island development states who are facing similar problems.
I know it's the focus of the conference, but how do you address that?
Well, as I said, we think that there's been a large gap in the supply side solutions which involve agriculture. So you can prioritise policies which invest in particular local staples for the domestic market. We have a range of policy tools. We talked about trade policy. So the Pacific Islands are exploring making certain categories of food and beverages more expensive to discourage people from consuming them. And that's worked for cigarettes and alcohol. So at one level, you can discourage, and therefore local foods become relatively cheaper and more attractive. You can have price control lists where we try and artificially lower the price of certain categories of food to ensure consumers have access to them. We don't do that for any local foods. We don't generally take a nutrition lens to that policy so that we ensure that people have cheaper access to better quality, more nutritious food. There's also interventions around promotion of, you know, backyard gardening or small-scale agriculture, which has not really been the domain of agriculture ministries in the Pacific. They're focused on exports. Agriculture is cash as income, not as food. And so changing our approach to how we teach people, you know, what to farm and how to farm, particularly at that smaller level, is an important new step. And you see some wins in countries like Samoa, who've managed to invest a lot in taro production and achieve a relatively cheaper taro production there.
The sights, sounds and tastes of the Pacific have been on display at a festival in New Zealand's Bay of Plenty. But beyond the food and festivities, organizers hope the Pacifica Festival in the Bay will help raise awareness of student achievement in the region's small but growing Pacific community. Joe O'Brien has more.
Nerve-wracking but fun seem to sum up the feelings of the children and young people performing in the festival. More than 15 schools took part in the event at Arataki School in Mount Maunganui. Halim Gardena Hano from St Mary's Primary School in Tauranga says Pacifica was pretty good.
Because we get to show all our what we've learned at practices, and we just get to show everybody, and it's just good to be just with, like, islanders, not always surrounded by Pākehās.
For one of the festival organisers, Annette Laban, that's what Pacifica in the Bay is all about.
It's about the children, and it's about making sure that they know who they are, our Pacifica kids, who they are and where they come from. By performing and making them feel comfortable around their culture, they can celebrate with others and see who they are.
Education Ministry Bay of Plenty Wairiki Director Ezra Schuster says coming together is especially important for the small community in the Bay, with just 1,500 pupils identifying as Pacifica across the region.
There are some challenges around that, around the isolation, and I think the importance of that Pacifica in the Bay Festival, it's an opportunity for these communities to come together to celebrate their cultural language identity, but also for the wider Bay of Plenty region to really to acknowledge that we've got some fantastic communities out there, and it's great to celebrate all of them.
Ezra Schuster says the homegrown event, which was initiated by local Pacifica teachers, supports strategies in the Ministry's Pacifica Education Plan by involving parents in their children's learning.
evidence tells us that for those communities where their culture and language is celebrated, particularly where there's high parental involvement and engagement, the chances of achievement are higher. So you've seen that at Arataki School, with a number of parents, grandparents, uncles and aunties and wider community members coming to school and being part of the festival.
Ezra Schuster says they're already seeing strong gains in Pacifica achievement results in the Bay of Plenty through initiatives supporting students and their families. The Pacific Island Community Tauranga Trust runs an after-school program attended by parents who work with their children on their studies. The Trust's Interim General Manager, Alex Talapau, says the festival is great for the diverse community, which includes people from Samoa, Tonga, Solomon Islands, Tuvalu, Kiribati and the Cook Islands.
The parents who are here as well are really embracing the chance to meet other communities as well. So it's like a marriage of the different Pacific Island groups coming together as one.
Organiser Annette Laban estimates about 1,000 people turned out to support the festival.
Fabulous feedback. People are just in awe of the colour, the performances, how much food there is.
For the many non-Pacifica children performing in the festival, such as Arataki School pupil Anika Shaw, it was a chance to learn a little about what the Pacific has to offer.
I learnt how to shake my hips like them, and I learnt how to do a hula.
This was the second year the Pacifica Festival in the Bay has been held, and with the community growing as more people move down from Auckland, it's hoped it will come back bigger next year. This is Joe O'Brien.
Many people in the Pacific are praised for their artistic ability, but feel the pressure to pursue other career paths, say Arts Award recipients in New Zealand. Seven artists were recognized at the Creative New Zealand Arts Pacifica Awards in Wellington. Daniela Marote-Cox spoke to the winners about the significance of their awards.
Madison Nonoa started singing at the age of 3, charging her family to attend her concerts in the living room. She's a recipient of the Yosefa Inari Memorial Award and considers Inari one of her role models.
Yosefa Inari, who was a Samoan baritone, really pioneered the way for young Pacific Islanders in the world of opera. It's not, you know, there's not a huge amount of us, so he did a lot of work in raising awareness.
Madison Nonoa has been training in opera for 14 years and just completed her studies in French, German and music at the University of Auckland, where she was also a student mentor. She's passionate about helping students focus on their education, but says many feel the pressure to let their artistic talent fall by the wayside in favour of a career as a doctor or lawyer.
Basically, every Pacific Islander I've ever met has either loves music or has some kind of affinity with it and is very gifted. But yeah, there's a lot of pressure actually from the wider communities to leave it as a hobby and to do something else, which, you know, is fair enough in lots of ways. But I think that there's an enormous amount of potential out there and talent that I'd love to see more people coming through.
Changing those attitudes relies on more Pacific role models championing the arts as a skill and a career. Poet Carlo Mila, whose works on Pacific culture, politics and love are regularly used in school curricula, is the winner of the Contemporary Pacific Artist Award. But she says becoming a writer was never something she considered as a job prospect.
When I was a university student doing a couple of English papers, I was, because there were so few Pacific people, I was included in their promo video. And they were asking me why I took English, and I was like, oh, because, you know, it's good for jobs, that you have good grammar and stuff like that. Like, I didn't go, oh, I'm going to write a poetry book one day. You know, I was just very practical, and it was just very much out of the realm of what was normal for people around me.
But she says the trend is changing.
Poems like mine were a bit rare or new when they first went into schools. But there are lots of Pacifica voices now that are telling a different kind of experience.
Preserving those experiences is the passion of the recipient of the Special Recognition Award, Kolokesa Uafa Mahina Tuai. She's the Pacific Project Curator at Tāmaki Paengahira Auckland War Memorial Museum, a traditionally unfamiliar environment for Pacific people, she says.
It's a foreign space, you know, the actual institution and building itself, but in terms of the concepts around display and exhibiting, it's not foreign to our cultures, you know, but we have sort of, through various projects, we've come to realise that there's also a lack of awareness and deep understanding of what museums actually do.
She says Pacific communities are starting to realise there are particular roles which safeguard taonga in the museum, but some might be surprised by the items that are chosen.
You might have a particular work that looks really worn out. Someone has worn it and it's tattered, but the story and the person that wore it is just as important, so we would consider that quite valuable and still acquire it.
The Arts Pasifika Award started 20 years ago to commend Pasifika artists and showcase their talent to the wider community. Other award recipients include Oscar Keitley and David Fane, who both won the Senior Pacific Artist Award, Tuaina nurse Tamarua Ropati, who received the Pacific Heritage Arts Award, and sound and music producer Anonymous, who won the Emerging Pacific Artist Award. This is Daniela Mawate-Cox.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International, heard through our partner stations and the World Radio Network. If you'd like to listen to this program again or cast past editions, you can subscribe to the program in iTunes. Just go to pcjmedia.com and click on the link for Focus Asia Pacific. If you'd like to let us know what you think of the program, well, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Perron, wishing you all, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.